Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mike from the Solution on the Shore Group in Neptune, New Jersey.
How you doing? My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. I practiced that like 5 times. I usually use my last name with everything, so that's one accomplishment here so far. So I want to thank Lauren for having me out in the group, for inviting me out to speak tonight. And I do believe it's an honor and it's a gift to speak, even though it doesn't feel like it. Usually I get like super nervous and I'm like super in my head about like what I'm going to say and all this other stuff. And is it going to sound good? Are people going to agree with me and all this other stuff? But I've come to know and understand and learn that like this is not about me. It's not about how good I look or, you know, if people respect what I have to say or agree with it or anything like that. It's about connecting with people. And I really agree with that. It's my heart. And so, you know, usually when I come up here, I pray beforehand, God, take away my fear and show me how to be. And if I can connect with one person tonight, you know, that's a success, you know. Because that's what a speaker did for me in the beginning is, you know, I had all these walls and all these barricades and blocks built up inside of me. And I wasn't like, I was trying to just like, you know, be in the corner by myself, you know, looking on, trying to, you know, hear something of hope or whatever. And I've been to a lot of different places. I've been to like, you know, therapists and counselors and, you know, school guidance counselors and whatever, and nurse's office. I've been to like so many places looking for help and like never, people have never just been able to reach me. And I don't know like, you know, why that is. And I'm not trying to downplay any of their fields, but it took an alcoholic just sharing his story, you know, just sharing a message of hope and inspiration. And really, not even coming from like this spiritual hilltop of like, you know, the successes and the accomplishments and the riches that he's achieved. It's really about how broken he is. And I think that we're all able to connect with each other due to our brokenness. I think that's what it's really about. So hopefully by the end of my story, you'll see how broken I really am. For better or worse. So my home group is Solution on the Shore. We meet in Neptune, New Jersey. Saturday nights is our main home group. We have another meeting on Friday and Monday nights too. And that's been, you know, it's been ingrained in me, like, you know, having a good home group ethic. That's the one spot where I'll show up early. I'll show up a few hours early, greet people at the door, you know, hang around with the people that I know and that I've come to form relationships with, and make coffee and do all these mundane things that don't really seem to be of much value. But it gives me like, you know, it gives me some stability, you know, because I go there and that's the one place where the people know me, you know, through and through. And I do have a sponsor. His name is Anthony. He told me to mention him a few times. He'll be listening later to the tape. And he knows he's my sponsor. Sometimes, you know, maybe more than he would like to, but he knows he's my sponsor. And I sponsor other guys today. And sponsorship is the one thing that, like, really saved me in the beginning, because I would try to, like, go to meetings and, you know, try to get a good hopeful message and carry through my day and, you know, really, like, thrive on that message and, you know, that's going to be the game changer for, you know, my perspective and stuff like that. But it took a sponsor to really, like, teach me what alcoholism is, to teach me what it means to be an alcoholic. Because I also came in here, like, with all these, like, preconceived notions of, like, you know, maybe I'm crazy, maybe I'm a drug addict, maybe, you know, I just have a chemical imbalance. Like, I don't know what is wrong with me, but there's something really fundamentally, like, you know, damaged. And it took a sponsor just to break that down. You know, he took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he laid it out very simply, which is what I needed. He didn't, like, try to, you know, dissect it too much and, you know, make this big thing out of it. He just gave me simple messages, like, do you have an allergic reaction to alcohol? And he explained what that means, just an abnormal reaction, just a reaction other than, like, you know, the moderate drinker, other than, like, you know, people who can drink successfully and normally without repercussions. Can I safely predict what's going to happen to me after I drink? And I came in here, like, thinking that, like, I wasn't under this this control, you know, kind of thing. Like, I had control. I'm just choosing to you know, switch my path. I'm choosing to change my mind. You know, and this is like the serious illusion that I'm sure a lot of us had. You know, I have my mind set on a certain number And I'm, whether it's, you know, drinking beer, which I never really liked, or, you know, taking down some shots with friends, you know, I'm going to stick to that number and, you know, go home and, you know, ride out the rest of the night. And every single time, you know, something would kick in, something like a switch would happen, whether it's through the first drink or the third or the fourth, eventually something would come around to like, you know, you're already at the party, you're already here, you know. You've worked hard throughout the week, you know, I'll build up some sort of justification to, you know, or reason on why I should be here and why I should drink more. And that's always been the case. And like, you know, it took a sponsor just to break that down. Like, you know, you had no control. You never did. You never will. And thank God for that. You know, just the simple, thorough explanation of alcoholism, you know, combined with the spiritual malady, which I've also had my whole life, still do sometimes. And the mental obsession that follows. And so I grew up in Sussex County. That's all the way up north, very top of New Jersey. And I didn't have a traumatic childhood. You know, I used to want to build up my story to make myself seem like a victim, you know, of all these hardships and stuff. I was spoiled. I grew up, you know, with two loving parents that supported me, tried to build morals and you know, good ethics and codes of conduct. And I was given everything that I needed and, you know, a majority of what I wanted. And the spiritual malady in me was just, you know, it's just never enough. It might be a little bit, you know, to butter me up and to get me going and happy or whatever for the moment. But after, like, give it like a week or two or something like that, and I'm just dissatisfied. You know, it's not enough. It's wrong. You should have got me that other t-shirt or whatever. Or, you know, you couldn't have got me those shoes. Like, you know, whatever the case is, you know, I'm unsatisfied and I'm insecure. And that has been most of my childhood. My childhood was, you know, built on fear and anxiety and worry and constant tension of like what other people are going to think and how are they going to judge me? Am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to form the right friendships or whatever and be popular or whatever? I'm always stuck in my head. And so going throughout school, you know, it was hard for me to try to click with people. Like there would be people, you know, forming up in little huddles and circles, and I, you know, I thought that everybody was talking about me and how stupid I was or whatever, and like, you know, I'm forming judgments, and you know, I'm starting to hate them before they even know me because they're obviously against me, and so I get into a lot of trouble in early elementary school, and I got into, you know, detentions and suspensions, and the list goes on, and eventually it came around to the time where, you know, after my parents were trying to have me see doctors and get hooked on Ritalin and whatever and, you know, all these different medications and being diagnosed everywhere. And my parents are like, you know, they're just trying to help. Like, they just see me, like, going absolutely nuts and causing all these disturbances and chaos and everything like that. And they're trying to put their finger on what the problem is and they're trying to seek professional help. And, you know, they just couldn't help me. As much as they tried, as much as, you know, they were good intentioned, they just couldn't, you know, they couldn't bring me back down, you know, to a level of calmness. And eventually me and the friends I formed were skateboarding around town and, you know, vandalizing things or whatever. We pull into the backwoods and they pull around this, you know, cheap handle vodka, whatever it was, like rubbing alcohol. And I remember watching everybody and it was like going around the circle and I'm looking at them and like they're cheering each other on and taking big swigs and stuff like that. And of course, like, you know, my self-esteem is low, so I have to prove myself and I'm like slamming this thing down and it tastes gross and it smells worse. And, you know, my first experience with alcohol, I was like projectile vomiting over all of my friends and they had to like babysit me and, you know, they brought me to a pizza place and they kicked me out because I passed out in the pizza parlor. And I got, like, you know, grounded by my parents. They found out. It was a horrific experience. So, you know, I tried doing it again successfully, like a few days, a week later, whatever it was. And I remember that day when I hit the mark, I just remember, like, all those fears, all those judgments, all those, like, you know, anxious feelings that I've had, they were all kind of, like, they were tuned down a little bit, like the volume was turned down just enough where I could just kind of talk to people and I could be myself and not have to like script every word that comes out of my mouth and make it sound filtered and good and, you know, intelligent or whatever. and I could finally just be free. And what alcohol did was, you know, it liberated me. It liberated me from myself. And that's been my biggest problem all throughout my life is myself. You know, I stand in the way of any kind of success that I'm out to get because I'm just blocked by myself. I'm like on myself so much where it's painful. So what alcohol did was it freed me from that. And I remember like thinking to myself, like, I don't know why the whole world isn't completely wasted right now. Like, this doesn't make sense to me. Because what it did for me was it gave me, you know, that liberation, that freedom. And, you know, I was going through the list, like, my principal could be using a drink right now. My parents need to drink. You know, all these people, you know, that are angry and, you know, whatever, and bullies and stuff like that, they could all be drunk right now and the world would be fine. And so drinking took, like, a really serious priority in my life, you know, right out of the gate. I started off fairly innocent, you know, drinking on the weekends, stuff like that, hanging out with friends, trying to be social with it. And it just started to transfer over into like my mind has this ability to justify and rationalize literally anything. So it started out like, I'll just drink on the weekends. I'll keep it to the weekends, keep it social and free and fun and stuff like that. And then, you know, over the course of time, like, I'm already hungover on Monday, you know, so I'm already a little bit drunk during the weekdays, so I might as well carry this out to the weekdays. You know, I'll start to have little thoughts like that, or like, why not make the weekend longer? I'll start on Friday or Thursday. And then before you know it, I'm like in that phase where I'm drinking throughout the week and I have no remorse. And, you know, there's no guilt or shame attached to it. And I remember, you know, taking my dad's pain pills and stuff like that and trying to seek other things or whatever. And I'm the kind of guy where if you put anything in front of me that offers, you know, like a non-sober experience, I'm going to take it, you know, automatic, hands down. You know, I'm not one to turn things down. And so drugs quickly became a big part of my life, too. And I respect the primary purpose of the group, but, you know, I have alcoholism. I have the allergy. I have that abnormal reaction. And so I'm doing my thing, and I'm going through high school, barely graduated, you know, I was like a D student at best. And they passed me, I think, probably just to get me out of the school. And now I have no responsibilities. I'm like, I'm in the world, I'm getting like these low-level jobs or whatever, I'm working, you know, at like fast food restaurants and stuff like that or whatever. And I'm just hanging out trying to, you know, pass the time so I can get drunk again. And that's my main priority, is to get drunk. Everything else is like an obstacle. Everything else is like, you know, standing in the way of me getting drunk, and I have to like follow suit in order to get to the point where I can get drunk again. And I'll say that, like, you know, I usually share it when I tell my story, is that like as time went by and as my alcoholism progressed, so did the flexibility of my morals. Everything started to stretch out. The things that I wasn't willing to do the day before was now a little bit more acceptable, because, you know, that prize was in sight, like getting drunk and getting high or whatever, you know, the case is. That was like right at the end of this. So if I just got to get over this one hurdle, that's what I'll have to do. And I got into a lot of trouble. And so I'm partying a lot and I'm hanging out with friends, and my friends deteriorate too. Like, the kind of quality friendships that I started out with, like, they quickly, you know, went into, like, you know, the people that really didn't have many morals or really didn't care about their life, and, you know, they were only out to get theirs, and we didn't really even care about each other, so I couldn't even really call it much of a friendship. We're all kind of just on the same team trying to get the same thing, and, you know, at whatever cost. And so coming around the age of like 20, 21, something like that, I had this like notion that, like, you know, I'm not legally binded to be in my house anymore. Like, my parents have no control over me. So I came up with the idea that, like, New Jersey was my problem. You know, the cops are out to get me. My parents are always on my back. I'm walking on eggshells all the time. So I might as well just move to South Carolina, where, you know, I'll put some distance in between me and my, you know, my home or whatever, and I'll have no problems. You know, I'll drink successfully, I'll drug successfully, and everything will be fine. And, because I had been arrested a bunch of times at this point. The cops know my name, they know my vehicle and stuff like that. So I figure the cops are the problem. The police enforcement is the issue. And so I moved down to South Carolina, And my parents, trying to be good parents, you know, they threw a few hundred dollars at me, trying to help me to get supported when I get down there. And that was gone even before I left New Jersey. And we moved down into my one friend's aunt's house. And we pretty much took her house hostage, you know, slowly but surely. We ran over her house. You know, what was her stuff became our stuff. We were bringing in people that, you know, she didn't know. We were siphoning gas around, you know, her neighborhood and stuff like that, and just stealing from, like, local stores or whatever. And just, you know, we were getting crazy, bringing people in the middle of the night. There were fights breaking out. Things were breaking. And eventually, after a few months, it got to the point where she was like, you know, I don't feel safe with you in my house. You guys have to go. You guys have to leave. And so we panhandled our way back up to Jersey. And this cycle just continues. It just goes on and on and on and on. And, you know, I'll spare you all the war stories. But eventually got to the point where my parents caught wind of what I was doing, and, you know, it got more intensified, and they sent me off to a rehab. And I don't know, like, because in the past, you know, they would have, like, they would have been like, go to rehab, and I would have been like, no. I'm, you know, I'm over 18, you have no control over me, I'm not doing that. And they shipped me off to a rehab, and I just surrendered because I was broken, you know. I moved back in with them prior to that because things got hectic or whatever, and they gave me, like, this strict guidelines to follow. Like, you're going to have a curfew, you're going to be sober, you're going to have a job, to and from the job, nowhere else. You're going to, you know, call us every so often, let us know where you are and how you're doing and stuff like that. And as strict and, you know, as corny as it sounded, like, I was willing to play ball because, like, it beat the lifestyle that I was living, you know, every day trying to hustle up money to do what I got to do, you know, hanging out with people that are prostituting themselves, hanging out with people that are, like, you know, into violence, watching over my shoulder, stuff like that. And I didn't have to look out for, like, you know, where's my next meal going to come from? Am I going to have a place to stay? Is it going to be indoors? You know, all that type of stuff. And so I was willing to play ball with that. And, you know, like I said, the cycle continued and I eventually got caught. But I ran, you know, maybe a few months into that, like, life just became unbearable. That's what happens every time that I get sober. Every time I get sober, the first thing that comes back are my judgments. And it usually shows up in, like, this weird way of, like, you know, I'm playing the victim card and the world is out to get me and I don't know what this person's problem is. And it just becomes so apparent how many idiots are like, I'm surrounded by. You know, that's where my mind goes, as arrogant as that sounds. I told you I'm flawed. You know, like, my mind goes to that place where, like, I'm surrounded by idiots. I'm just surrounded by people that are annoying. They're always on my back. They always want more from me. And, you know, I look at the people in my job, like, they're able to show up late with no repercussions. And, you know, I have to show up early and I get no acclimates. Like, what's the deal with that? And I start to think about all these different things. And so a few months in, like, I get a little bit, like, stressed out and anxious. And I find the one guy that gets drunk and high, and we're off, you know, on a spree together. And that, like I said, that continued for a few more months or whatever, however long it took. And my parents called me, they shipped me off to rehab. And I've been to rehabs before, I've never taken it seriously, but when I got to this rehab, I tried it one last time, I got drunk one more time in that rehab, and I got away with it. And the next day, I remembered, that's when I got sober. It was in somewhere in April. I remember thinking, it was like this moment of clarity that I got. And I think that we all go through it from time to time. As far as like the fog just kind of cleared away for a second. And I was able to, like, cognitively see, like, where I am and what I'm doing and what I've become. And, you know, the location that I'm in, the predicament that I'm in. And, you know, just this long, you know, strand of, like, you know, me just destroying my life and myself and all these other things. And it became really clear that I was in bad shape. And that's the surrender that I really needed. It didn't come in, like, a physical form. It didn't come in a financial form. It didn't come, like, psychologically. It was on, like, a spiritual level. Like, I felt bankrupt. I felt like I had nothing to live for. I had no hope. And I was going to die. And it was a tough place to be because, you know, we've probably heard speakers share before, you know, I didn't want to live. And I didn't have the courage to kill myself. So I'm, like, stuck in this weird purgatory of, like, purposelessness. And that was probably the greatest day of my life. Because that shifted me to a place where I could finally surrender. I could finally get enough out of my own way in order to hear somebody else and to listen and to not like criticize them as they're speaking, to open my ears to something other than what I've been telling myself my whole life. And that's what I really needed. I needed to just shift myself out of the way in order to be able to hear a message, to hear something else. And so they made us mandatorily go to these meetings and get our meeting slip signed. And I would sit in the back row and I'd cross my arms and try to play the tough guy and, you know, not hear anything. And I don't know whether I heard this guy share or he cornered me after a meeting maybe, but, you know, somewhere along the lines I heard this guy talking and, like, he wasn't sharing, like I said in the beginning, he wasn't sharing about how successful he was, how, you know, promising of a life he had. He was talking about, like, his defective mind. He was talking about how, like, screwed up he was, you know, how he had all these fears and anxieties and worries and, you know, constant resentments and, you know, he's pissed off at the world and he couldn't find a reasonable solution and he went through all these avenues to try to fix himself and nothing worked. And that's the message that I could relate to. That's what broke down this barrier of indifference between me and him. And that's where the identification started to happen. And that's what it's really about. We're here to identify with each other. I mean, that's what keeps me going. As much as I don't want to come up here and share, and, you know, it's all about me in the beginning, something happens in the midst of when I'm talking, you know, my mind gets transferred to this place where I'm purely trying to help another individual, just like somebody else helped me, with no, like, you know, rewards at the end of it, you know, no self-gratification or accolades or anything like that. He was just trying to help me. And so he became my sponsor, and we started going through the steps. And I'm still in this rehab at this point. I'm like 6 months in or whatever. I stayed there for a full year. And we would travel through the steps together, and he showed me what it was to be an alcoholic. And I came in here very agnostic. I came in here, you know, not wanting to do anything with God. I wanted to have nothing to do with it. And we started out slow. Like, if I'm completely honest, he probably became my higher power to some extent. But he also gave me that avenue of, like, you know, why don't you try the group of AA? Why don't you try AA as a whole? It's a collective, you know, force of people and energy and people just like you that have recovered. So why don't you put some of your stock into that? And we continued on through the steps. And he didn't make it, like, this big obstacle and this big avenue, like, where I couldn't surmount it and I couldn't, you know, pass it. He made it so easy for me. And that's what I needed. And I told that guy everything in my fourth step, from my resentments to fears to sex conduct to harms, even everything that wasn't related to any of that, stuff I was just, like, you know, feeling guilty about or embarrassed and all this other stuff. And I shared it completely with this guy, stuff that I was definitely going to take to my grave. No one's going to hear this, about this stuff. And I can't say that I felt free in that moment, like, talking to him about that. But after a few days, like, it came to me, like, you have nothing. You know, you don't have to act anymore. You don't have to play this character. You know, you could finally just be a real, genuine, authentic person, at least with this guy. And then, you know, you can tiptoe around with other people and try it with them and try to be transparent. And that's freedom. You know, my whole life I've been an actor. My whole life I've been putting on hats and, you know, masks and trying to play characters. And I've been basically just trying to show you what I thought that you wanted to see, for whatever the motive was, whether to impress you or to get something from you. I was never a real person. I was never honest. I was never able to have genuine relationships with people. And I think above all, that's what we're here to do, is to connect with each other and to form those relationships and to form those connections. And I believe that, you know, deep down in my heart, because that person formed a genuine connection with me. And I finally felt like I could put my trust into this guy. Like, he wasn't going to screw me over. He wasn't going to hurt me. And so, like I said, I was in there for about a year in that rehab in Morristown. And I graduated. And they shipped me down to Asbury Park, which is right around the area I'm at now. And so I'm still not well yet. Like, I've been through some of the steps. I've been about halfway through. And I'm still a little bit delusional. Like, I think that, like, I got to tune up. And now it's time where I can live a normal, successful, healthy life. You know, I'm down in Asbury Park, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to get a girlfriend, a house, the white picket fence, you know, the whole image. And everything is going to be fine. Everything is going to be absolutely fine from here on out. And I'm going to have no more problems, nothing to worry about because I've been fixed. And so I'm working like double shifts at this Cuban restaurant down the street. And they're letting me live transition rent-free. And I have no problems. I have nothing, no responsibility, nothing to worry about. And I'm going to work every day, working double shifts around the clock, you know, from sunup to sundown. And I'm making money. And everything on the outside looks decent, at least. It doesn't look good, but it looks decent. And slowly but surely, my judgments come back. They always do. And it's so annoying because I'm so quick to, like, find out where people are wrong and where people need to, you know, elevate themselves and get better and, you know, treat me better or whatever. You know, this person got snippy with me and I'll hold on to it for the rest of the day. So, like, I'm going through this life completely judgmental and completely insane. And over a period of time, you know, I'm still sober at this point. I'm, like, 2 years sober. And life got unbearable, again, in sobriety, which is another point that I try to share. I mean, I'm sure that most of you know it. Time doesn't equate to good sobriety. It doesn't mean anything. At least in my experience, it doesn't. You know, I could easily have, you know, multiples of years and be completely out of my mind and crazy and dissatisfied and insecure and not seeing any kind of value in life. And I think that's an important message to share. Because for the longest time, I thought that if I'm separated from drinking and drugging for, you know, X amount of time, I'm going to be in better standing to be, you know, more successful, more healthy, you know, more intelligent or whatever, more joy inside. And that's just not the case. And so 2 to 3 years sober, I got extremely depressed. I got suicidal and I started cutting myself. And so self-harm was, you know, never something in the cards, but it, you know, I have a disease that demands relief. It demands treatment. And that'll come for me at any cost. Anything to rip me outside of myself. Because I think, you know, like, bad sobriety, somebody said it before me, you know, everything I say is usually quoted, but, you know, bad sobriety is the number one cause of relapse. And that's why I need to have these steps and good sponsorship and working AA and being ingrained in it and, you know, fully, you know, implanted in this thing. I need to be in the center of this thing. Because I'm not a well guy. I'm not, you know, I'm not well-minded. I'm not well off without AA. Like, I turned very sick, you know, fairly quickly. So I'm the guy, I need the full package. So I'm about 2 or 3 years sober and I'm cutting my wrists and I'm, you know, fantasizing about suicide. I see no purpose in life. I see no reason to go on. Every day is just another, you know, quest just to get to the pillow at night, just to start it over again. And it's hopeless and useless. And I started talking to a few people, and a couple people told me to go, you know, to the psych ward. A couple people told me, like, you know, why don't you just go back to AA? It seemed to work out for you before. You know, you weren't like an angel, but you definitely weren't, like, you know, crazy and suicidal. Why don't you try it? And so I went back into AA, and this is the only thing that's ever saved my life. This is the only thing that's really fully, for a long amount of time with longevity, given me inner peace and calmness. And it's not consistent. I'm a human being. I go through life, you know, like a crazy person sometimes. But this program has absolutely everything that I could possibly ask for to help carry me through all that stuff. And so I got back into AA. I started going to a local clubhouse, the Shoreline Club. And that's where I met my first sponsor down there. And we went through the steps a little bit. He went into the Coast Guard. And then he passed me off to my now sponsor, Anthony. That's twice I mentioned him. Just got one more to go. And so we started this journey again through the steps. And, like, I had been a little bit exposed to it in the beginning, the first 6 steps at least. And, again, he just took me through the book, maybe not page for page, but he outlined each step in each different section of the big book. And, you know, I would look at people like him and call them big book thumpers and, you know, whatever the case is, and like, oh my God, they have no lives, you know, what a bunch of losers. And, like, you know, I had no idea. I was living in, like, this fantasy world, you know, where I was expecting everything to just get better, you know, naturally. But it takes work and it takes action. And so we started going through the steps together again. And this guy knows probably more about me than I do about myself. We've been going through the book for, you know, about 5 years now. We've been working together for about 5 years. And thank God for him. You know, he sacrificed his time, his energy, his money, his patience, you know, everything. And that, I think that's another thing what this whole thing's about too, is sacrifice. Because I got to be able to sacrifice my time and like what I want to do. I got to be able to sacrifice that for somebody else who needs help. Because that's like the real essence of how I get outside of myself. You know, it's not when it's convenient, when everything is convenient and, you know, the cards line up and everything. And, you know, my show is over and I have some free time, then I'll take your phone call. You know, I got to be able to drop what I'm doing to try to help somebody else, just like somebody else helped me. And I remember when I first came in here, I was in bad shape. You know, I had a lot of ideas. I had a lot of hopelessness and I had a lot of confusion. And this guy, he just sat down with me. You know, no rewards or anything. He just sat down with me for the sake of helping me. And, you know, I learned paradoxically he was helping himself too in the end run. But thank God for that. Thank God for good sponsorship. That's been ingrained in me, you know, from very early on in sobriety, is that, like, I need to be looking for people to help. Like, a lot of the times I want to go to a meeting and see what kind of a message I can grab and see if the speaker is going to be any good and all this other stuff. But it's really about trying to see who's raising their hand, who's counting days. And even more so than that, people that have been in AA for a little bit that might have just fallen off the rails a little bit, that might be having a hard time, and having enough, you know, empathy and sympathy to see through that and to try to reach out to them. And that's how we survive here. We help each other. And so so he took me through the steps. I shared the 4-step with him. We're going through, and I'm making my amends. And I swear, like, the amends that I thought were that were going to go really, really well and really good, they were complete opposite. It was terrible. All my ex-girlfriends I thought were going to be, like, you know, easy passes and stuff like that. Like, just keep doing what you're doing. It's going to be okay. No big deal. You know, we're still friends. And I thought my parents, you know, were going to be the opposite of that. And it turned out completely the opposite of what I thought. You know, my ex-girlfriends gave me a long laundry list of stuff that I did wrong and stuff like that. And my parents were the ones that said, you know, we're just glad that you're alive and you're doing well. And I remember he drove me to my parents' house the one day, and it's a good thing he did, because I probably wouldn't have gone, because my legs were shaking, I was, like, trembling, my heart was racing, whatever. I almost threw up on their doorstep. And I go into the house, and I'm, like, trying to remember the format of what I've been instructed to say. You know, like, this is how I was wrong, this is how I, you know, this what the stuff that I did, was there anything that I left out, how can I make amends, how can I make it right? I tried to, like, stick that in my head. And I got through the door, and I'm already, like, stuttering, and I'm already trembling, and I'm sweating already profusely. It's already been, like, you know, 30 seconds. And I remember, you know, my mom, you know, she was just like, we're just glad that you're doing okay. We're just glad that you're happy. And it took me a while to, like, see in hindsight. When I went to South Carolina, I wasn't contacting her, you know. It must have been, like, a year and some change before I even gave her a phone call. And I remember she said the same thing on the phone. You know, I'm glad you're alive. And it's stuff like that that I really need to make an amends for. It's not, like, so much the financial part of it, which is important. You know, can't, like, you know, take away their money. But it's more about, like, what I stole from them as far as, like, security, their calmness. They're going throughout their day, you know, they're wondering if I'm alive or dead, if I'm in jail, you know, what's going on. And I can't even imagine that. I'm not a father, you know. I'm not that role. I don't have that dynamic. But I can imagine that, like, if I loved another individual, another person, like my parents loved me, it would be heartbreaking. And that's the stuff that my sponsor was able to point out to me. And that all, like, all this stuff, it's like a gift because it allows me to see the truth. You know, I'm not the perfect AA. I'm not the perfect guy going through this stuff. Like, I drag my feet. I'm argumentative, I'm combative by nature. I want to be right, and I want to have answers for everything that you throw at me. But thank God for patient people. Thank God for people that are willing to keep poking me until it gets annoying enough that I'm willing to, like, surrender and do some action. And through that course, through that experience, I'm able to see the truth about myself and about the role that I have. And, you know, it's also been told to me that, like, I can't play that victim card anymore. I'm very used to playing the victim. That's, like, my automatic go-to is, like, how other people are wrong, how they should be more sensitive to me, and how they should be more affectionate and, you know, compassionate, and, you know, how I'm not getting what I need, and, like, life is all wrong around me. That's, like, my go-to. That's, like, my natural place to go. And victims get drunk. That's been my experience. I've seen it. And that's not, like, a judgment or, you know, any kind of thing that I have. That's been my experience. I've seen people play that card, and they're so quick to just go back to drinking, to go back to drugging. And before you know it, I see them overdosing or, you know, caught up in whatever else, you know, happens. They relapse. And so I got to be able to be the villain. You know, I got to be able to see where my role is, where I'm at fault, where I'm wrong, how I got the ball moving, you know, the momentum that I started. And it takes a sponsor to be able to point that out to me, because a lot of the times I'm so emotionally invested in, like, whatever situation it is, whether it's work or whether it's family, and I'll come up with ideas and excuses and justifications on, like, why I might be a victim this time. And it's never the case. He's always very quick to point out, like, you know, no, you're probably being an idiot. You know, this is probably your fault. You should probably go over there and make amends to her. And thank God for that guy. I mean, like, if I had a pushover that was, like, not a pushover, but, like, somebody who was willing to co-sign all of my thoughts and ideas, I would just be running my own life just, you know, via this person. It would just be, like, me filtering myself through this guy and, like, running the show again. You know, this guy, I gave him spiritual consent to let me know whenever I'm wrong, whenever I need correcting, or whenever I need, like, adjustment or, like, a recourse. And that's the role that I try to take in the guys that I sponsor's lives now. I try to take that role. They might get annoyed. They might think that I'm wrong. But ultimately, they understand that fundamental concept that, like, I can see the vantage point of their life, stuff that they might not be able to see. They might be overlooking it due to emotion, due to feelings or whatever. And what started out as, like, a curse, like, you know, I'm cursed with alcoholism. You know, this is terrible. I can't believe God did this to me. It's like, I'm uniquely qualified to help people. We all are. And I can't tell you how many people I've seen, professionals that have been, like, really, you know, full-heartedly trying to help me and get down to the root causes of, like, what's going on inside of me. And they couldn't really, like, reach me. You know, a lot of them were just simply saying, like, you know, drinking might be an issue. You might want to stop drinking. But they don't know what drinking is doing for me. They don't know the effect that it has over my life. You know, the remarkable, you know, shift in perspective that it gives me, at least in the beginning. And so it took an alcoholic to break down all those barriers. And we can reach people that nobody else can reach. And that's a gift. Sometimes it doesn't feel like a gift. Sometimes it feels like more of a burden, because they usually call me at, like, inopportune times, but I need that. Usually when I'm, like, watching Breaking Bad or something, or, you know, I just got off of work and I'm, like, tired and I'm ready to take a nap. I get a phone call from the sponsee and it's annoying. But, you know, those are the things I need to do to stay sober today. Those are the things that I need to continue to do to stay sober today. And I gotta say, like, there's been a lot of hard times that I've faced in life. You know, back before I tried getting sober, my grandfather died. And I was close to my grandfather. And that was an easy pass. That was a green light. Like, go drink, go do what you got to do to get right, to feel better. You know, and nobody's going to blame you. And my mom was, when I first got into rehab, she got sick. And she ended up in the hospital for, you know, a bunch of years on and off. And she underwent a bunch of different things with white blood cell count, all these different things going on and whatever. And she ended up getting really sick and she ended up dying in 2015. And, you know, that would have been like a very easy freebie, just to go out, get drunk, get hammered. Nobody's going to take away from you. Nobody's going to, like, you know, try to tell you not to do it. Like, that's a freebie. And I remember drinking didn't even cross my mind. I felt it. I felt the hurt. I felt the pain. But it wasn't like this, like, you know, seeking an excuse to get drunk or to get high or whatever. or to get outside of myself. I remember like maybe that week I took a commitment into a psych ward. And AA has been a saving grace for me. And it is grace because there was a lot of my sobriety where I wasn't fully invested. I wasn't trying wholeheartedly to, you know, move my feet and to do all these actions and be a surrendered individual. Like, it wasn't like that. A lot of the times, I absconded from AA. I had my own ideas and thoughts and stuff like that. I wouldn't take suggestions and stuff like that. And by all accounts, I should have been drunk. I should have gotten high. I should have, like, you know, relapsed or whatever. And especially when I got down to Asbury Park. So it's been grace, you know, from a God that I didn't want to believe in, that's taken a role in my life that I'm, you know, forever grateful for. And God is probably one of the most important things besides good sponsorship that I have in my life now. And I've went to church. My mom was a Sunday school teacher. She tried to bring me up with, like, you know, this core belief in God and, you know, God loves us and stuff like that. And I rebuked that. You know, I thought it was stupid and that she was a lunatic. And, you know, come to find out that, you know, God's always been with me. Whether I call it God or higher power or, you know, put any kind of religious stamp on it, it doesn't matter to me. To me, it's just the sense that there's something bigger than me watching over and guiding my life and providing some sort of support and structure. And the only thing I got to do is seek it. That's it. That's why I come up here. I come up here because, you know, not to sound corny or sappy, but God put me here for a reason, whatever the case is, whether it was to substitute for another speaker or just, you know, talking to another guy about that. You know, God placed me in certain positions for a reason. And I believe that it's not to, you know, float up my ego or to make me feel better about myself. It's to help somebody else. And there's opportunities all throughout my day with that. I just got to be able to be observant enough to see it. There's always opportunities for service to help somebody else. And I believe in that to my core. Because not only is that what takes me outside of myself, I can take away or at least help them get on the path of taking away that pain that they're dealing with. And so my life is pretty good now, today. I have a decent relationship with my family. I have friends that I can really call friends. I have a good home group. I'm used to wearing a shirt and tie. I know that was like the group's, you know, thing that we do. We do that every Saturday. Home group's been like really implanted in my head. Like, you know, you show up early, you help people, you make them feel welcome and stuff like that. And, so I have a good life today. I'm pursuing sign language in college. I have a good job. And, it's not really about the things that I got. It's not about financial successes. It's not about material possessions. It's about the inner feeling that I can have. And it's not happiness, it's joy. It's joy of helping somebody else. It's joy of connecting to people, of living a life that is beyond me. You know, I can live this life and know that there's a higher purpose in store and I just got to walk the path and hopefully move my feet faster than my head. And that's, you know, my sponsor always hits me with that. You got to move your feet faster than your head. My head can move like really fast. It can come up with like a lot of ideas very quickly. So for me, all I got to do is move my feet in a forward momentum and my head will catch up to all that. You know, it'll start to pan out and it'll start to all make sense. And so it's experiential to me. This whole thing is about just walking through it and not treating it like a book study or homework or something like that. It's just an adventure. You know, it's a way of life. And I've surrendered to AA. AA is my life. I'll forever be indebted to AA. And I'll, you know, to the best of my ability, try to remain a surrendered individual. And if that means driving 2 hours or, you know, wherever, it doesn't matter. Because that's what I need to do. That's what I need to do to help people. And a little short on time, got about 10 minutes, but I want to thank the group and I want to thank Lauren for having me out here. And hopefully somebody got a connection out of that. So thanks for letting me share.